Hello, welcome to the Whistleblower Newsroom. I'm Christine Borgeson here with my co-host Celia Farber. Today we have a very special guest. One of our big efforts here on the Whistleblower Newsroom is to keep a continuing spotlight on Julian Assange and what is going on with him. And with that in mind, our guest today is one of the world's preeminent human rights lawyers, Dr. Nils Melzer. He's a professor in international law at the University of Glasgow and has been Swiss human rights chair at the Geneva Academy since March 2016. Since September 2016, he has been the United Nations Human Rights... By the United Nations Human Rights Council, UN Special Rapporteur on Torture and Other Cruel and Inhuman and Degrading Treatment and Punishment, which is where Mr. Assange comes in and where Mr. Melzer meets Mr. Assange. Throughout his career, Professor Melzer has specialized in legal questions arising in relation to the prohibition of torture and ill treatment, the use of force in military, police, and counterterrorism operations, the regulation of private security service providers, and the use of cyber operations, autonomous robots, and other new weapons technologies. He has authored numerous works on these issues, including the book Targeted Killing. I want to read a quote from Dr. Melzer, before we welcome him on the show, because I think it sets the stage for this show. He wrote, "In 20 years of work with victims of war, violence, and political persecution, I have never seen a group of democratic states ganging up to deliberately isolate, demonize, and abuse a single individual for such a long time and with so little regard for human dignity and the rule of law. The collective persecution of Julian Assange must end here and now." Dr. Melzer, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Christina, for having me.
So I would like to start with your account of your visit with Julian Assange back in March. I'm very curious to know what has to be done by a UN rapporteur to get the access, and how the whole thing happened, how the whole thing went down, as they say. And what happened during your visit and after?
Well, thank you very much. Well, yeah, as a special rapporteur on torture, I'm mandated by the UN Human Rights Council, which is obviously a state or interstate multilateral institution, to monitor and report on the compliance of states with the prohibition of torture and ill treatment. And I can do this in various ways, but the three main pillars are that I visit countries, a number of countries per year, where I evaluate their prison system and kind of on a collective basis, their legislation and so on, and see whether that's compliant with the prohibition. I also submit thematic reports where I pick up a generic topic, like, for example, torture occurring in migration context or in corruption context or, you know, kind of, or in healthcare settings and so on. And I bring that to the attention of the international community. And the relevant kind of third pillar here is that I do on a daily basis individual interventions, that's to say diplomatic communications on behalf of individuals exposed to torture or the risk of torture, that may be extradited to a country where they're likely to face torture or ill treatment, or that are in arbitrary detention and being exposed to interrogation under torture and so on. So I can intervene. I have access to all the foreign ministers of the UN member states and can basically get to them within 24 hours and make a written communication asking, you know, to address the risk and protect people, individuals, from torture and ill treatment. And so I can get contacted at any point, at any stage of a specific case. So it's not somewhere, you know, in a strict order. So, for example, that you would have to exhaust all the national remedies, judicial remedies, and only at the
so
last
you can just call the foreign minister, like, did you just call the foreign minister of the UK and say, I would like to go visit Julian Assange?
Well, I don't call him on the phone, but I did write a letter, yes.
Okay.
That's basically what happened. I wrote a letter to the foreign secretary of the United Kingdom, and I said, I'd like to visit Mr. Assange in prison. Obviously, well, I first actually wrote to Ecuador because I wanted to visit him while he was still at the embassy.
And what happened there?
And, well, I made a request, a public appeal first on the 5th of April, calling on, because there were rumors that he might be expelled from the embassy, and I appealed to the government of Ecuador not to go forward with any expulsion before I could see Mr. Assange in and assess his situation and the risks he would be exposed to in case of an expulsion and see him in at the embassy. And I said I would do this within 2 weeks, so I wouldn't be dragging my feet. But then within, 6 days,
right?
They expelled him from the embassy. Yeah.
Okay. So how long did it take you?
Followed up immediately with a request to the British government and, you know, called on them certainly not to extradite him to the U.S. And to allow me to visit him, which was then granted by the U.K. government.
How long did that take?
Well, the reaction was quite quick. I made my request immediately after the arrest, and I visited within a couple of weeks. So I visited on the 9th of May.
So talk to us about
basically within 1 month of his arrest.
Oh, yeah. I thought it was March. I'm sorry. So talk to us about that visit. How did you find him? What did you talk about?
Well, I was granted a 4-hour slot, which was 2 hours in the morning and 2 hours in the afternoon, because I took with me two medical experts. I knew that I was going to get into a very politicized case.
Yes.
Where I wanted to have, you know, medical evidence. And so I took two independent medical experts that are very experienced in assessing torture victims and that can distinguish symptoms that are produced by ill treatment from, you know, other medical symptoms that might come from an accident or from sickness and things like that. So I took a psychiatrist and a forensic expert that I usually take with me also to country missions. So I know them well, and I know they're very experienced. And so they examined him for 3 hours separately from each other. And I also obviously talked to him and assessed, you know, his general conditions.
What did you ask him?
Well, I mean, there's the interviews obviously go, you know, into various areas of his conditions of detention, his current, you know, state of health. I wouldn't now be able to disclose all of it because there's something like a, you know, doctor-client
privilege,
confidentiality with regard to his private sphere. But in general terms, it's about assessing his current well-being, any types of, you know, ill treatment or harassment he might have gone through that might influence his current conditions, but then also, you know, the current conditions of detention, his access to legal aid, to family visits, to medical care, to his ability to prepare a defense in his ongoing legal proceedings. And so it's obviously a broad range of questions that are being addressed in order to be able to have a full assessment of his situation. So 4 hours sounds like a lot, but when you're there doing all of this in a professional manner, that's actually not a lot of time.
How was his health?
Well, we came to the conclusion that, I mean, his physical health was certainly not very stable, but because he had been without proper medical care for many years in the embassy. But I would say that most urgent kind of aspects of his physical health had been addressed by the prison health services. It was more his overall situation, his let's say his emotional, psychological situation, which was very difficult because he had been exposed to this kind of consistent campaign and of defamation against him and very humiliating treatment on the part of the Ecuadorian government in the past 2 years before his arrest, but also you know, by the U.S.
So he was very depressed, is that what you're saying?
Yes, well, he showed a pattern that would be typical for someone who's been exposed to psychological torture over a prolonged period of time. That we're talking, obviously, well, any prisoner is to a certain measure affected by depression because obviously it's a difficult situation. But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about a pattern of symptoms like severe depression, severe and especially continuous anxiety.
Yeah.
You know, where a person that can never relax, has this kind of post-traumatic stress disorders. And so you have all a combination of these factors that are indicative for having gone through traumatic events. Now, in his case, and that's different than when you're interviewing someone who just came out of a war zone.
Yeah.
He's been lived in a very controlled and surveilled environment for several years. So if he produces these symptoms, then it's fairly easy to tie these symptoms to causes, because there's not many factors that could have influenced his life in such a severe way. And so we could actually identify the causes for these symptoms with a high degree of certainty. And that certainly was the constant kind of anxiety of being exposed to a highly arbitrary judicial environment where he knew he was not going to get a fair trial, because in the past decade, he had been exposed to a systematic violation of his due process rights in every single jurisdiction that where there were procedures against him, be it the Swedish proceedings that were highly arbitrary, be it the U.S. secret, you know, indictments based on secret evidence in the closed proceedings, be it the U.K.'s, you know, behavior after his, with his arrest and after his arrest, since his arrest, where his due process rights have been repeatedly violated, blatantly violated, and then Ecuador, not to speak of Ecuador, that deprived him not only of his asylum status, but also of his citizenship, which is not possible according to the Ecuadorian constitution, without due process, without even, you know, giving him a chance to take a lawyer and basically react to this and have a trial, you know, have a normal judicial due process proceeding. So basically, it was just one morning the president decided, today I'm going to expel Mr. Assange, and that's what he did without any due process.
So, can I ask you something? I just want to cut in for a second. Is it your legal assessment that he is being tortured, that this amounts to torture?
My assessment is that the decade we're talking about, since 2010, he has been exposed to various forms of cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment that cumulatively produce the effects that are equivalent to psychological torture. So I'm not saying he is now,
of course,
you know, specifically and deliberately tortured, but he's exposed and being deliberately exposed to conditions of detention that, in combination with what he has gone through, the constant arbitrariness he's being exposed to still produce these effects, the same effects as psychological torture would. Yeah.
This is Celia Farber. I want to ask a question, Dr. Meltzer. How does he keep hope alive?
Well, I don't want to speak for him. But what I can say certainly that he is a very intelligent and very resilient person. But I think that doesn't come as a surprise, because he has obviously been, you know, he's been also publicly expressing his views already after years of being holed up in this embassy and being exposed to a range of arbitrary kind of treatment by various states. So he's certainly a very resilient person, but you know, he's not superhuman. We're all human. And at some point, people crack.
Yeah.
And I think it's that's why I rang the alarm bell, because what we said and what the two medical experts said is that this man has been exposed to severe trauma. And if his surroundings are not, if this pressure is not relieved soon, then his medical situation could deteriorate rapidly. And that is exactly what happened. 2 weeks later, or was it 3 weeks, he was no longer able to participate in his extradition hearings. And so he had to be moved to the medical wing of the prison.
The psychiatric wing?
Well, it's the healthcare wing where they have, you know, I don't think there is a separate psychiatric.
But are you saying that he had a psychological breakdown?
I have not, you know, he was moved to the medical wing, but I wasn't involved in that
decision. It's all connected. If you're constantly producing cortisol, eventually your whole body breaks down, your adrenals break down. The psychological and the biological are not separate.
So is his incarceration, in your view, legal? His incarceration in the UK?
Well, see, if you're taking it as I'm a lawyer, so I know that you can argue cases in different ways. If you just stick to the very formalistic level and say, well, this person is wanted for extradition by the United States. The last time he was about to be extradited, we released him on bail and he absconded. He basically sought refuge in the Ecuadorian embassy. So that's why we now have to preventatively detain him in order to prevent that from happening again. Now, that sounds reasonable. But if you think about it, he's not absconded from British justice because he wanted to avoid legal proceedings in Sweden. He all along said, all I want is assurances from Sweden. They will not extradite me to the U.S. And because Sweden didn't give him these assurances.
Well, now, when the U.S.
Let me explain. Okay. Then he sought refuge in the embassy. So he was a political refugee. And that's, every persecuting state says of its refugees that if they escape their rule, that they're absconding. But in international law, it's called seeking asylum. So in my reading, his detention now is not lawful because what he is being sought for, why his extradition is being asked, is because he's done simple journalism. He hasn't committed a crime. He's not even accused of having committed a serious crime. The only thing that could be punishable is this accusation that he should have tried to help Chelsea Manning to crack a computer code, but unsuccessfully, so didn't succeed. So no harm was done. So, you know, how many times does someone try to decode a computer code and doesn't succeed, and how many people are extradited and persecuted, you know, for a decade for these types of offenses? So this is a minor offense that would never justify these types of prosecutions.
And I would like to weigh in and say I'm half Swedish, and I read the Swedish police report in Swedish, the 100-page report, and I was absolutely shocked. There is not a scintilla of rape or forced sex of any kind in the
even the broken condom did not have any DNA.
There's
nobody's DNA was on this
broken condom with no DNA. There's false evidence that's been introduced, but it reads, forgive me, but like a dime store novel. When they took the witness reports from the women, their feelings about him and why didn't he call or text, or these were consensual situations in Sweden entirely, and it's absolutely infuriating, Sweden aspect.
Yeah,
of it.
I mean, his seeking
asylum.
But
can we just talk about that for a minute?
Well,
because
yes,
that's where it starts, if I may. Sweden is where
it
starts.
I understand
that. This completely insane non-rape. In the police report, there's no forced sex in the rape. There is there is arguments, not even arguments, there's tension about condoms. He's asked to wear condoms. Sorry to get so granular and personal, but this is, for me, this is where it starts.
I know it starts there, but what I'm trying to get at is the illegal aspect of what's occurred to him. You know, quite apart from, I mean, it's been proven that, you know, these girls weren't raped. They themselves say they weren't raped. If he was jumping bail, he was jumping bail on a on a trumped up charge anyway. And then they, you know, they're keeping him. I mean, didn't they send him to jail and keep him there because of the bail jumping business? I mean, explain to me. And also asylum.
Sweden had to drop its. It never was a case. They didn't drop the case. It never mounted to a case. Correct, Dr. Meltzer? It never. There was no case in Sweden in the end.
Yeah.
So I'm, why isn't Sweden?
I've read this, you know, I read Swedish as well. So I've read all the original documents as well. No, Sweden has never pressed actual criminal charges against him. They're still, after almost a decade, in the preliminary investigation phase. So we're talking. He's not charged with anything in Sweden.
Exactly.
There are allegations.
They should be charged with malicious prosecution.
What's really important is the women didn't say they were raped.
Precisely.
But the state said,
yes.
You tell us your story, and we interpret it for you because it's an ex officio offense. So basically. They said, you women don't own the story. It's the state that owns the story. We say this is rape.
That's fascinating. Ex officio. Could you just clarify what that means? It sounds like Latin.
It's an offense that is prosecuted automatically by the state.
Not
the victim that has control over it.
Oh, good
it's
God.
Not the victim suing the
but
perpetrator.
But there are no victims in this case.
But don't you hear what he's saying?
Yes, I do.
The state is deciding.
I do. The state is deciding that they're victims, even though the victims themselves say they are not victims. Is that correct?
Precedent.
That's Orwellian.
One of them, I think, if we're absolutely objective about it, one of them did say that she had been molested by him.
She was half asleep.
Yeah, well, that was...
Halv sov in Swedish, remember? Halv sov in Swedish. She was groggily half awake, yeah.
But, you know, I don't think we necessarily have to... It's not up to us to pass judgment as over, you know, whether he did or did not misbehave or commit even a certain offense. But when someone committed an offense, then he has certain rights. The first right is to be presumed innocent. And the second right is to have a right to prepare his defense and to be prosecuted.
Correct.
If, you know, charged or basically acquitted, right? So if he is charged, well, then this has to be done within a reasonable time frame. And you can't spread, you know, a rape suspect narrative for a decade almost.
They just created
without
a
even
trap.
Pressing charges, mm-hmm. And this is so harmful to anyone's reputation.
Is that legally actionable?
I want to say one more thing.
Spending that time, you know, not giving them a speedy trial, is that legally actionable?
Sweden's not doing anything normal or legal in this whole
thing. Well, I know. I'm just asking, okay. Can somebody sue Sweden, the state of Sweden, for that?
Of course. Well, it's a human rights violation, certainly.
And is that being done then?
Well, it's not. I don't see that happening. But there's so many layers to these legal proceedings going on against him, and I obviously I'm not his defense counsel. What I can see is that the result of these types of arbitrary proceedings are that he has suffered intensely under that, and he has no way of defending himself properly against these accusations. So I think what we have to see here is it's not up to us to say whether he has committed some offenses or not. But if he had committed some offenses, then he would have, you know, you would need to have proceedings according to the rule of law that give him all the facilities. Since he has been arrested, he has not had sufficient access to his lawyers in Britain for a very long time, until just very recently, had no access whatsoever to legal documents. So that is a grave violation of due process in a country like the United Kingdom. And that, I think, is something that should be a fundamental concern to all of us, and that cannot be tolerated.
There was another law that was broken in Sweden. Forgive me for cutting in, but this is very urgent. In Sweden, there is a law that you cannot put the face of an accused rapist or criminal on the newspaper, on the cover of any newspaper.
Of course.
You have to pixelate them.
The confidentiality, the anonymity.
Confidentiality. And there was, yes, Julian Assange's face on Expressen as soon as this, right, let's call it a rumor hit, or how Expressen got it, I don't know. Do you know how this went from the police station and the state?
They got it directly from the prosecutor. it was the same evening. So these women, the story, as I understood it, goes like this, that the one of the women was concerned that she might have contracted HIV. So she says that he tried to have intercourse with her unprotected, that she then asked him, well, do you have HIV? He said, no, I don't. And then she let him continue. So this was, in that sense, consensual. But afterwards, she got worried she might have contracted HIV. She asked him to take an HIV test. He said, it's not necessary. I've done one. I'm not going to take another one. You know, calm down. She got more agitated. She went to the police and wanted to ask whether she could force him to take an HIV test. And the police jumped at this and made a rape case out of it. When she learned during her questioning that the police intended to arrest him on suspicion of rape, she refused to sign her statement. She interrupted, she terminated the questioning and went home. But the prosecutor, the same evening, confirmed to Expressen, the tabloid press, that Assange was suspected of rape. And although the woman basically had cut short the questioning out of protest and left and sent a text message out of the police station to a friend saying that I don't want to accuse him of anything, but the police want to get their hands on him, and so that they're making up the charges. So if we have that evidence, then there's something wrong in the state.
I've written about this piece in American and international, about this the Assange rape accusations in great detail. That text you just referenced, is that something a journalist could get a hold of? I'd like to get a hold of that, those text messages. I think this is important.
Well, they are available as quotations online now. What's important is the defense lawyers of Julian Assange were not given actual copies of these text messages. They were allowed to read them and to copy them down, to basically write them down on paper so they knew what they would remember the wording. But the prosecution service of Sweden refused to hand them the actual copy of this.
Shouldn't that be illegal? Because that's evidence. That's discovery evidence, and the way that exactly. They're offering that evidence to Assange's lawyers implies that they want to be able to have they want to be able to say, well, no, that's not true. We have the originals, and we know that that's they don't have the originals. We do, and what they say is not true. I would like to do an exercise with you. Could you, starting with Sweden and going to the other countries, give us a bill of particulars of the laws that those particular countries have broken in dealing with Julian Assange?
Oh, yeah, well, sure. I mean, let me perhaps.
I know it's
this
a big
way.
Question.
Everybody says, you know, this is just about Julian Assange having to face justice, face that this is just about applying the law to him, and that that no one is above the law, and that he tried to escape the application of the law. Now, if this was about applying the law, he would never have been convicted and sentenced for a bail violation, simply for seeking and receiving political asylum by Ecuador. That's impossible. It's not only a mitigating circumstance, it's a justification for him not respecting bail conditions if he receives asylum, because a state recognizes that he is being threatened by persecution and needs protection. Obviously, he will not expose himself to extradition. It's just like any refugee we have in our countries. We're not saying that they're absconding because they're not going back to the countries that they're persecuting
them.
Right. So that's the first point. It's a complete turning on the head of the principle of asylum. Yeah. And the second one is he would not now currently be under extradition detention for a U.S. indictment for espionage simply for having done journalism, simply for having published true information about the misconduct of government.
Right.
That's the other thing. It's press freedom. It's the freedom of opinion that is so highly protected in the U.S. itself. He has done nothing but basically publishing true information.
That's so there has to be some burden of proof or some rationale, legal rationale, that will allow the Brits to extradite him to the U.S., right? The U.S. has to submit some kind of legal rationale, don't they?
Well, they say he's being accused of an offense under U.S. law, and the British will say, well, we have an extradition treaty with the U.S., and the only reasons for us to refuse an extradition is, for example, for the death penalty where the European Convention of Human Rights would prevent that, or if there is a risk of torture and ill-treatment. So the U.S. will say, don't worry, we will assure you, we will give you diplomatic assurances that we will not expose him to the death penalty or to torture or ill-treatment. And then the British will say, we have no reason to doubt the validity of these assurances, and so now we can extradite him.
But isn't he already being subjected to torture and ill-treatment just by virtue of what's already happening and the fact that he's sitting in this prison, decomposing?
In my assessment, he is, yes. And in my assessment, he has no chance to receive a fair trial in the U.S. if he's going to be sent to the District of East Virginia, to the State Security Court and the so-called Espionage Court, and exposed to the kind of secret grand jury proceedings that we know from these types of cases. He has, in my assessment, there's no, if someone has a chance to receive a fair trial, it needs to be conceivable that he can be acquitted if he's not guilty. Is it conceivable that Julian Assange would be extradited to the U.S. and a U.S. court would actually acquit him? It's not conceivable.
Well, why is Daniel Ellsberg walking free?
It's a political case. Right? He has exposed the U.S. in a way that the U.S. Perceives as threatening. And my reading is that they're trying to make an example of him to scare others away that might be imitating him or might be tempted to imitate him.
Well, he is a threat to the national security state. There's no doubt about that. And to the war efforts and so on. But so what legally can you do to
help him?
Yeah.
Well, you see, my role is to report, and I did. That's what a rapporteur does, right? So I did my analysis, I did my examination, and I reported, and I wrote to the U.S. and the U.K. and the Ecuador and to Sweden, official letters in the end of May. I've received the last response. Now, it was just published today by the United Kingdom, which wrote back on like two paragraphs saying that they reject all of the allegations and that he could have left the embassy at any time. So,
what?
Clearly, all
but now he can't leave prison when he's served his term.
It's amazing. Any notion of responsibility for this abuse that he has experienced. So now I can take it further, I can, correspond further with them, but I have no enforcement power. In the end, it's public opinion that decides, and public opinion has been very misguided in this case.
It's been engineered over here in the U.S., I don't know, about the U.K. too, I mean.
Well, I certainly have been affected by this public narrative as well myself, because initially I was very cautious to get into this case. Because I had been affected by what the press had been spreading for
That's
a decade.
Interesting.
Because I've never really worried about this case.
What do you mean
before.
You've been affected?
Tell us. That's very interesting.
Well, his lawyers first contacted me, I think it was December last year. And I had this kind of visceral reaction I was afraid that I might be manipulated. I had this image of Assange as the hacker, rapist, spy, and narcissist.
Sure.
And then I questioned myself in some quiet moment and asked, well, where do I get this judgmental kind of conclusions
good
from.
For you.
Because I don't know the man, and I've never dealt with the case before. So I got intrigued, and when they contacted me again, and that's what happened in March, I actually opened the books and started looking into the case. And the deeper I looked into this, the more I saw that these kind of, prejudice that I carried in my mind was basically based on fabrications, that there was very little substance to support these types of assumptions. And that's how I got into this case. And that if it is like this with this case, how many others are there? And so we really need to ensure that we have a media system that works, that can actually check on governments, that governments have checks and balances that actually work, that the judiciary actually oversees what the government is doing. But what we see in states like the US and the UK, in both of them, the parliament, the Congress in the US, the parliament in the UK, that have had a subcommittee that investigated the involvement of their governments in torture and rendition in the CIA policies after 9/11. Both of them came to the conclusion that their governments have been deeply involved in torture. And now the judiciary would need to, has an obligation to investigate and prosecute under international law. But they don't do that. The government prevents judicial investigations. Both in the US and in the UK, the government basically prevented this from happening. So what this means is nothing else than that governments of these states are refusing to prosecute international crimes, including war crimes committed by their own officials.
Right.
And if that happens in the US and the UK, who have so long been served as examples of, leading in the human rights movement, well, what does that mean for other states?
I want to ask you a somewhat subjective question. In your circles, what is the mood, the esprit, the dominant attitude about Assange now?
Well, to be honest, it's still very much influenced by this misguided narrative. I think there's very few people who actually, make the effort to actually look behind the surface.
Still.
And yes, I
wow.
think it starts
That's shocking.
To change. It starts to change, but it still is the predominant attitude is still, well, there's something fishy about this guy. I don't have the time to worry about this. And certainly people are afraid to be associated with him and to want to keep their distance, and certainly, media outlets refuse to, publish about him or, so it's certainly a huge reluctance there by many actors to be too closely associated with him because of the negative impact it could have on them.
So let me ask you something.
That's
you said
terrible.
That you got a response from the UK. What to your final assessment, what were the responses from Sweden, from the US, and from Ecuador?
Well, basically, they all simply just rejected whatever I said. Well, the UK wrote half a page. The US wrote one page. I think the Swedes wrote a couple of pages. I don't know, with five, six, seven pages or something like this, and Ecuador 16. But the message was always the same. Basically, I got they just simply reject any allegations of abuse or misconduct, but they also, what I asked them to do is to investigate, to conduct an independent and impartial investigation of what happened. I didn't go to them and said, basically made a judgment, but I said my conclusions based on the facts at my disposal are that he shows all the symptoms of a person, typical for a person that's been exposed to psychological torture. Now that means under international law, the Treaty Against Torture, the Convention Against Torture says, and all of these countries are party to that treaty, says that whenever there is reasonable ground to believe that torture, an act of torture has been committed in the jurisdiction of the state, they must conduct prompt and impartial investigations. So it's not the question whether it has happened or has not happened, but as soon as there is reasonable ground, and if the special rapporteur on torture of the United Nations with two experienced medical experts comes to the conclusion torture has happened, that is reasonable ground.
Who adjudicates infractions of that treaty?
It is the Committee Against Torture of the United Nations. So
the UN?
Certainly, there's the United Nations Committee Against Torture, that is the treaty implementation body for that treaty.
Yeah, but what court would adjudicate those infractions?
They have a judicial-like function. It's a quasi-judicial function. That's basically quasi-court for this treaty. But a case needs to be brought, which obviously would be a case that his lawyers would then need to bring. And that has not happened, to my knowledge.
So let me ask you something else. What about The Hague? Where's the international? I know the United States is not a signatory to the International Criminal Court, but are any of the other players signatories?
And yes, they are. I mean, certainly Britain and Sweden are. For Ecuador, I'd have to check. But the thing there is, it's the International Criminal Court has jurisdiction over war crimes. And now we're not talking about the crimes that Assange exposed, which some of them would probably amount to war crimes. But his ill treatment is very difficult to construe it as a war crime. Because, well, you would have to say it's linked somehow to the Afghanistan and you know, Iraq wars and so on. But it's torture, which is internationally prohibited. But it's not a war crime. Is it a crime against humanity? A crime against humanity are mass atrocities. It's not it's an individualized crime. You see, it's not a mass atrocity. So that's why it doesn't easily fit. Actually, it doesn't fit into the crimes that the International Criminal Court is authorized to prosecute.
That's very interesting. Maybe they need to update their list of prosecutable crimes.
Well, the states would need to agree to this, right? And I mean, the various states in the world that are party to the treaty. But the point here is that states have their own national responsibilities, and as citizens of our states, we need to insist that our governments oversee each other, or let's say the different powers that the judiciary controls what the government's doing. And that's something that citizens have to insist in the democratic process, that this is a priority.
Yeah, but if you have a propaganda machine, an international one, it appears, one in here in the United States, one in the UK,
one in Sweden.
That how
broke
exactly?
Its own media laws.
How
do
you
this?
Bring that pressure to bear so that these treaties are this key treaty is respected? That the laws of the rule of law of these countries and the laws that would pertain to this situation and Assange's situation in particular are enforced. How do you do that?
Well, in the end, really, I think that's why the press is so important, why media are so important, that we have an independent media that actually reports and actually oversees and monitors what government is doing and are actually informing and empowering the public rather than just entertaining them, right?
What has been your experience?
I want to ask straight out, the mainstream dominant left-leaning press, for example, I know The Guardian had a terrible, strange vendetta against Assange. Can you just speak to what's the left's problem with Assange?
Well, I have to, you know, I can't explain everything, but I can say that I certainly share the opinion that mainstream media has colossally failed to report objectively on this case. But when you see that established mainstream media houses find it more important to report on Assange and his cat and his skateboard and all these, you know, smears that were spread about him, but even, established British mainstream media don't worry about evidence that his due process rights are being systematically violated by the British judiciary system, then that really, to me, shows that they have lost their bearings, that they don't fulfill their function.
If you look at a trajectory, there was a Hollywood movie recently about the Washington Post's decision to publish the Pentagon Papers, right? So this is the mythology of our whole media system, is that those who expose terrible things about war, you know, that's what the media is supposed to be all about, right? So what is this, turning against this individual who told us everything we would want to know about what's really going on behind the war curtain? I'm not going to say I don't understand it, because I think I do understand it, because he complicated things. I've wondered, what is the real rub, shall we say? Was it the DNC files? Was it the Podesta files?
It was the Manning film. I think that's what they're after him for, primarily.
Don't you think? Or is it all of it?
I honestly find it very difficult to understand what exactly the connections are. But I certainly, in every single argument that is brought up to justify this type of narrative against him, is so easily defeated, really. You know, whatever aspect you take, if it's take the DNC files, then he's being accused of having interfered with the U.S. democratic process. And then I think, well, what exactly happened? The U.S. citizens went to elect their president. No one prevented them from casting their vote. No one faked the numbers. So no one interfered with the voting process. What happened is that WikiLeaks published true information about one of the candidates, which showed that party actually had interfered with the democratic process.
Exactly.
And that must be why the media,
interfering.
Yeah, because that's who is the media. The media in the United States is an extended arm of the Democratic Party, if you ask me, most of it, you know.
Well, and so now, if they can't live with the fact that they've lost the elections to the president that they currently have, well, you know, it's not going to help to blame someone else, because they have soon elections coming up again, and they might have to, you know, better get their act together and see what the problem was. But that's not my role. Yes, I'm not, you know, it's, well, what I can see is just that this is not a justification
I think there are powerful forces arrayed against Julian Assange. The Pentagon was not amused. Obviously any high level political force or government agency that is exposed doing something illegal or engaging in malfeasance or unethical, they don't want that kind of exposure. So I think he has an array. I mean, even the way as you're speaking to us, you're telling us that these countries are engaging in illegal act. They're not even paying attention to their own laws. They're not even applying their own laws to this case. And nothing's happening to them. They're not being held accountable for that. There's no accountability for that, which is really critical. And so they are doing this with impunity because they are powerful. And so it's completely understandable to have when who was it? Former CIA director said that Julian Assange, I think it was the former CIA director,
yeah,
said Julian Assange is a rogue intelligence agency unto himself. That is the crux of the problem. These powerful institutions and individuals have never been unveiled like this.
Never.
And it's a global unveiling.
Yeah.
This is an unprecedented circumstance that Julian Assange has created. That's why he must be destroyed. Because the power elite, they can't, these major government you know, in all these countries, their agencies cannot withstand that kind of scrutiny.
That's right. Yeah, beautifully stated. I want to return to, could I have that Latin term again for what Sweden did?
Ex officio.
Ex officio? Okay. Now, this is for me a very important question. Is there an, have you ever seen this in your experience, that a state charges somebody when the alleged victim doesn't think they've been victimized? Is this, because this terrifies me. Have you heard of this before?
Well, yeah, I don't think it's the first time it happened in history. I think, you know, the law has been manipulated many times in all possible forms. And, you know, sometimes victims come handy, you know, to support a certain political interest, and sometimes victims are an irritation, and so we try to kind of make them go away. But what really strikes me here, that we have states that are normally considered to be mature democracies.
Right.
That certainly, you know, no state is perfect and mistakes happen and so on, but we're somehow convinced that in states like the UK and certainly like Sweden, if a mistake happens or an abuse of power happens, there is a legal remedy. So, which what we're saying, we're presuming that we have the rule of law, right? And not the rule of power. And what we see in this case, though, that power feels apparently threatened by what WikiLeaks and Mr. Assange have done, and that the rule of law does not function. That's why, to me, you know, with all human rights importance that Mr. Assange as an individual has, he's just as important as any other victim in the world, and we have millions of them. But what makes this case so incredibly important, that it sets a precedent for our complacency with abuse of power on the part of these types of mature democracies. If this goes through, if it becomes a crime to expose crime, then we really live in a society that is under censorship and, you know, potentially could come under tyranny, because there is no remedy anymore against abuse of power. If the judiciary doesn't do their job and actually hold government to account, and then the press or the journalists try to do it, and then they're being called spies and put into prison for the rest of their lives, well, then we no longer have democracy, then we no longer have rule of law. Then what we have is censorship and tyranny. And that's why I'm, you know, so involved in this case, because that really is a precedent that needs to be prevented.
What but did that going Italian... back to Sweden, though, when Expressen put Julian Assange's face on the cover as a rapist, hence your belief and everybody else's belief that Julian Assange was a rapist, and this is really where his deep reputation problems begin. The prosecutor eventually, perhaps a year ago or so, doesn't drop the case, but admits there was no case. I mean, I'm simplifying now. Why doesn't Expressen get sued somehow for the defamation?
Right.
Well, they're the press too, right? And so they asked the prosecutor, and the prosecutor says, yes, he is a rape suspect. Well, then they're publishing it. Well, just, you know, so in a sense, I wouldn't blame Expressen for that, because they're journalists. You can debate whether that's good journalism or bad journalism, but it's journalism. It is true that formally the Swedish prosecution service suspected Assange of being a rapist. That's not a lie. They did suspect him. They initiated an investigation, and they told the press that they did. The misconduct is that Swedish law prohibits to, you know, informing the press about a
preliminary
investigation.
So why did they do it?
So the misconduct is on the governmental side.
The government side, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I want Sweden slammed in by the United Nations. Why doesn't that happen? I don't see why they are skating so free here. Why aren't they condemned in a, I don't know all these courts, but do you understand what I'm asking? Is there a human right of complaint against Sweden that could be filed for what they did? Because I really see that they created this whole mess,
well,
and they're being completely blithe about
it. You may have seen my report that certainly is not being, very cautious about, choosing words to describe what Sweden has done in its proceedings. And I have been very carefully weighing my words before, but it was clear to me that the way Sweden has proceeded certainly was very arbitrary. But you see, the United Nations is an organization created by states for states. So it is not more powerful than the member states want it to be.
Right.
So the United Nations is not, going to intervene against the will of states because it's an organization of states.
Oh, my God.
So if you want to change the system, then you need to change public opinion in the countries, and they can then give more authority to United Nations institutions. But I think for now what's very important is certainly for me to maintain the dialogue with the governments, but also with the public, in order to inform them and what my observations are. And I certainly am just one of the actors with one specific mandate that's limited to issues of torture and maltreatment. And so I have to stick to that. But there are others as well. Certainly the media has a job to do. And certainly I encourage all members of our societies to engage and to consider what the risks are if we allow for the demise of democracy and the rule of law. And that 200 years ago, when we decided to become democracies and to do away with the aristocratic absolutist rulers, we divided power between parliament, government, and judiciary for a reason. Because we know that unchecked power becomes abuse of power. Not because these are bad people, because they're just human beings. Human beings, when they're not controlled in their exercise of power,
well, they do become bad people when they're not controlled. They do.
Yeah, it becomes abuse of power. And so that's why we need oversight. We need transparency. Absolutely. And if the courts don't do the job, and if the media don't, then, well, we have actors like WikiLeaks and Assange coming up and filling the gap.
Right.
So, right. There are issues we can discuss about the way WikiLeaks have gone about their business, about the various kind of the way they have public.
We are out of time. But we want to thank you for your service. You've been doing wonderful work.
You'll have to have a discussion about privacy, and the right to be forgotten in Google.
Dr. Meltzer, I have to cut you off, unfortunately. We want to have you back, but thank you so much. We're out of time.
Very welcome. Thank you for having me on the program.
Thank you so much.